All right. Good morning, Fairhaven. My name's Jeremy. I'm one of the pastors here, and we are going to dive back into the book of Genesis. And so if you want to follow along this morning, we will be in Genesis chapter 39. And real quick, a couple things while you're turning there. This morning, we're going to dive into Genesis 39 here, but I want to let you know, if you've ever wondered what it's like to dive into the stories of the scriptures in the land where they happened, we have the opportunity to lead another trip to Israel this coming May 13 to 24. If you're interested at all, if you have questions, we are having an interest meeting today at one of our other Harbor campuses at South Harbor Church, 1 o'clock today in the afternoon. My buddy Tim, who's the pastor over at South Harbor, and I will be leading an interest meeting. So I'd love to chat with you either here or there if you're interested. But today we're going to dive into Genesis 39. And before we dive into Genesis 39, I want to tell you a little bit about a show I've been watching a little bit on Netflix. How many of you have watched the show Quarterback? No, okay, I get it. A room this size, not everybody here are football fans. And so I'll tell you what I'm not going to talk about this morning is how, like, as Detroit Lions fans, like, this is our year, right? Like, what I'm not going to talk about this morning is how excited we all are because the season starts this week with our first preseason game on Friday. What I'm not going to talk about is how Jared Goff is going to have this breakout year because he's one of the most underrated quarterbacks in the league, and we've given him all kinds of weapons, right? What I'm not going to talk about is how Amon-Ra is going to make people look silly. I'm not going to talk about how I'm already planning on being at the Super Bowl parade this winter, right? We're not going to talk about that stuff, okay? What we're going to talk about is this Netflix show called Quarterback, and just as a little thing, there is some language in the show, so if there's younger viewers, there is some language. Maybe take a look at it first. But the show Quarterback essentially follows these three NFL quarterbacks, Marcus Mariota, and then it largely focuses on these two quarterbacks, Patrick Mahomes, quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, and Kirk Cousins, quarterback of the Minnesota Vikings. And what's striking to me in the show is that in a lot of ways, it kind of holds these two people together, right next to each other. You go from Mahomes to Cousins to Mahomes to Cousins. And what's striking to me is the difference between these two people. And nothing against Patrick Mahomes. He's an unbelievable quarterback. I feel bad he's going to start his season 0-1. But he's a fantastic quarterback. But what you find in the show is that for Mahomes, everything is kind of, it's big, it's loud, and when you go to Kirk, he feels different. He feels centered. He feels grounded. Like, there's something different about this guy. And the show actually shows us some of why. Like, he practices a Sabbath. As an NFL quarterback, he takes a day off every week. He has a counselor. He has this great relationship with his wife, with his kids, and it's fascinating how the quarterbacks in the show, they all face the same sort of things. They all have pressures in their jobs. They're all working through injuries. They're all dealing with the media, and yet somehow they deal with it differently. And again, I don't know Mahomes. I don't know his story. I'm sure he's a great guy, but there's something striking to me about the way Cousins deals with it all. So this morning, I want to explore some of that, right? The identity, character, what is it that makes us who we are? What is it that drives us? What is it that's true of us when things are going well, when we're at the top? And what is it that keeps us grounded, that keeps us centered when things aren't? And to do that, I want to jump into the story of Joseph. Because Joseph, we launched into kind of our little chunk in Genesis on Joseph, if you remember, a couple weeks ago. This past week, you now realize why we called last week's sermon the awkward commercial break, right, if you were here last week. But we started the story of Joseph 2 weeks ago. And we started the story where the book of Genesis starts the story with this. Anybody remember how old Joseph was when we meet him in the book of Genesis? It's this 17-year-old kid. And we looked at how this 17-year-old kid, he's given a coat by dad, And then something happens when he's given this coat that creates this giant rift between him and his brothers. And before we jump in, I want to spend a little bit more time looking at that coat. Because there's some details about the coat that we kind of left 2 weeks ago. Why is it that when Dad gives Joseph this coat, his brothers are immediately upset and need to do something about it? Like, on the one hand, it could be because it's just an ornate coat. It's an elaborate coat. But I think there's more to the story. Because let me tell you, the way that I grew up understanding the story of Joseph receiving this ornate coat from Dad, the way I typically understood it is that Joseph's brothers, they didn't have coats. And that at this moment, when Joseph is 17, Dad now makes Joseph this elaborate coat, gives Joseph this ornate coat, and now he has a coat, the brothers don't, they get upset about it, and now they hatch out a plan. But as I've come to understand the ancient Near Eastern culture, as I've read more of the scriptures, I'm less convinced that's the right read. Because in their world, in the ancient Near East, they live in a world where often, especially during parts of the year, it's really hot during the day, but then there are times in the year where it gets really cold at night. And so there is a common way to dress that you're going to wear an inner garment and an outer garment. Your inner garment is your tunic. Your outer garment is your cloak. Almost everyone in the ancient world is going to wear an inner garment and an outer garment. This outer garment, this coat, is largely going to be given you by Dad. Dad, if you remember, we've talked a little bit in the series about what we call a Beit Av. Beit Av means house of the father, or father's house. You have a patriarch, the oldest living male. This person is in charge of the Beit Av. They're responsible for providing for the family, for security, for provisions, for food, for well-being. You living in that world are going to be given a coat by Dad. So I would say it's highly likely, if not entirely certain, that all of them are wearing coats. You all have a cloak. So what is it about Joseph's? Well, on the one hand, yes, it's elaborate, but the story almost reads that when Dad gives Joseph the coat, remember, how old was he? 17. How many of you parents waited until your kids were 17 to give them their first coat? No, like, you give a coat to your kids when they're younger. I get, my kids are now middle school, so like, there's the weird thing, they will not be caught dead in a coat, right? Like, it's negative 10. I'm fine, right? Like, but it almost reads as though this coat that Jacob gives to his son Joseph almost reads as though it's the second coat. And not only is it a second coat, but this is the ornate, elaborate coat. And for us, that, okay, sure, what difference does that make? In Joseph's world, Joseph's brothers, that wouldn't have been lost on them. Because remember, if we go back to the Beit Av, this father's house run by the patriarch, do you remember when the patriarch dies, how does the family continue? Well, the firstborn son is the one who's going to carry the name of the family. The entire thing is going to go through the firstborn. What does the firstborn get that the others don't? A double portion of the estate, right? So we've talked about how if you're Dad, I've got three kids. And so if I live in the ancient Near East, I am the patriarch of my Beit Av. When I die, what I have doesn't get divided three ways, it gets divided four ways. My youngest two kids get a portion, my oldest gets double. If you have seven kids, it's divided eight ways. Your youngest kids get one portion, your oldest gets double. And so in Joseph's world, is Joseph the firstborn? No. When Joseph's brothers see, Dad just gave Joseph a set. We have one. Joseph has two. And Dad's not even trying to hide it, right? This is ornate. It's elaborate. It's going to draw everybody's attention. It's almost as if to Joseph's brothers, Dad is saying, this child is the one I see as my firstborn. This child is the one who's going to carry the family forward. This child, we talked in Hebrew, that word firstborn is Bechor. It's the one who carries the name forward. And in that moment, Joseph's brothers realize, this isn't okay. We need to do something about this. So they hatch out a plan. But again, the question, is Joseph Jacob's firstborn kid? No, he's not. The plain answer is no. But to Jacob, if we were to ask Jacob, it almost feels in the story as though Jacob would have maybe a different answer, as if Jacob might say, well, it's a little more complicated. And in order to understand that, we really need to jump back into the story of Jacob, into the mess of a story he's lived. Do you remember we met Jacob? When Jacob, as a young kid, if we follow Joseph's dad Jacob back, Jacob as a young kid, he tricks his brother Esau out of this birthright. He ends up dressing with this goat skin and essentially stealing the blessing from his brother from dad. And because of it, we watch Jacob have to run. And he ran to his uncle Laban's house, and we saw how when he got to Uncle Laban, he saw one of Laban's daughters and immediately fell in love, a woman by the name of Rachel. And if you remember the story, he promises Uncle Laban, like, I will work for you for 7 years for Rachel. And then on the wedding night, Uncle Laban tricks him, and he ends up marrying Leah. Do you remember the story? Jacob's firstborn, we read in Genesis 29 here. It says, when the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he enabled her to conceive, but Rachel remained childless. Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, it is because the Lord has seen my misery. Surely my husband will love me now. Jacob's firstborn is Reuben, and he's born in all kinds of muddy, tragic. Leah recognizes she's not loved. Almost in the story is like, if he doesn't love me for who I am, maybe he will love me for what I can do or what I can give him. Jacob's firstborn is born of Leah, a guy by the name of Reuben. Jacob will then have 9 other children, so he's got 10, and then we read he has his very first with his most beloved wife, the one he'd initially wanted to marry, Rachel, and we read it here in the next chapter. Then God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and enabled her to conceive. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son and said, God has taken away my disgrace. She named him Joseph. So is Joseph Jacob's firstborn? No. He's actually his 11th, but Joseph is his firstborn with his favorite wife, Rachel. And so it almost feels like to Jacob, those first 10 kids, those don't really matter. Because the one I care about most, the one I see as my Bechor, my firstborn, the one who will carry the family line forward, that is this son, my firstborn son with Rachel, this son named Joseph. And so it almost feels then like Joseph's brothers, they see this. Dad's not hiding it. We read in the story that Joseph is dad's favorite. Joseph is now wearing this elaborate ornate coat, and the brothers devise a plan to get rid of him. So we followed how Joseph was given a coat by dad. He's essentially the second in command in the family, right? As the Bechor, as the firstborn, you're essentially the second in charge. It's going to come down to you. We then see the brothers, they essentially strip that coat from him. They take that coat, they dip it in blood and use it as evidence of this lie that Joseph has been torn apart by wild animals. And they throw Joseph into a pit. What we saw was an empty cistern. Genesis chapter 37 ended with Joseph coming out of the pit and being sold. It ends this way. It says, meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. So 37 ends. Joseph is now on his way to Egypt. Last week, we looked at the awkward commercial break where the story between Judah and Tamar, which, if you want to do some homework, also revolves around a coat, right? Then we jump into this week, Genesis 39 starts right where Genesis 37 leaves off. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. So Joseph's in Egypt, but notice the story wants us to see the resume of where he's at, right? We have Potiphar, an Egyptian, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. This isn't just anybody in Egypt. This is one of these significant who's who. Joseph is now belongs to one of the top people in Pharaoh's entire court, the captain of the guard. And so the question for Joseph is, how's Joseph going to act? How does he respond? In the life he just lost, he's in this position of power, of prominence. He's almost viewed by dad as this firstborn. And now he's got nothing. Now he's in a place with people that are not his, in a land that is not his. How does Joseph respond? The story continues. It says, the Lord was with Joseph, so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. How does Joseph respond? Joseph responds, this is one of the reasons I find the story of Joseph so incredibly compelling, is because regardless what happens to Joseph, Joseph remains constant. Joseph remains grounded. He remains centered. I think if there's anything you're going to write down this morning, write down that Joseph is faithful. Right? Joseph is faithful, that time and again, Joseph does the right thing. Simply because it's the right thing to do. You know how, like, in life, it's easy to do the right thing when the right thing benefits us, right? It's easy to do the right thing when the right thing is easy. But what about when doing the right thing might actually put us in trouble? What happens if doing the right thing means the business doesn't advance? What happens if doing the right thing means we might end up in a funny place with our employer? What happens if doing the right thing doesn't advantage us? How do you respond? And in the story of Joseph, what we find is time and time again, regardless what happens to him, Joseph is constant, Joseph is centered, and Joseph becomes this picture of what it looks like to simply be faithful, to do the right thing simply because it's the right thing to do. Joseph, he ends up doing the right thing in the house of Potiphar. He ends up in charge of Potiphar's house, and the story continues. We find things go well. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian. Whose household did he bless? The Egyptians, Potiphar's, because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything who had? Potiphar, both in the house and in the field. So notice in the story, whose house is being blessed? Potiphar's. Who's being blessed in the fields with their flocks and their herds? Potiphar's. Joseph finds himself in a spot, that first place, when Joseph is essentially this firstborn. He's going to receive everything that dad has. So as that first house, as Jacob's house grows, Joseph stands to gain. Now, Joseph finds himself in a home with people that aren't his, in a place that isn't his. He continues to do the right thing, even though he has nothing to gain for it. Even though as he continues to be faithful, somebody else is gaining. Have you ever been in a spot like Joseph? where it feels like you're giving yourself to something and somebody else is getting the credit or somebody else stands to gain. And a little piece in the back of your mind goes, am I really going to keep doing this? Joseph shows what it looks like to simply do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. Again, why? Because Joseph continues to be faithful. The story continues. It says, so Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern him with anything except the food he ate. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome. You can almost feel the story start to turn, right? Like, uh-oh. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. Did you notice there's a piece that shows us some of Joseph's motivations in this passage? Did you notice when Joseph says, no, how could I do that and sin against, how's the response? How could I do that and sin against God? Joseph doesn't say, if I do that, I could get in trouble with my master. How could I do that and betray the person who's in charge? No, Joseph has this understanding that to do that would be to sin against God. It would not be the right thing. So in this situation, Joseph could have gone, okay, how can we cover this up? How can we keep it a secret? Because Joseph likely knows in this moment that in order to do the right thing, it might disadvantage him, right? To do the right thing might put him in a difficult spot, which it's about to do. But what we find is Joseph does it anyways. Why? Because Joseph is eventually, like, Joseph is faithful, right? Like, you wrote it down in your notes if you're taking notes. What does Joseph do? The story continues. It says, one day, he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me, but he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called to her household servants. Look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me. He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And at this point in the story, does anybody have like a sense of deja vu? You know, like that, like, hold on, like, it feels like we've seen this before. It feels like we've heard this story before. As I read the story, like, my little deja vu light in my brain starts blinking. Let me help you. Joseph is given a coat that has something to do with his role, his identity, as being the second in command in a household. That coat is taken from him and is then used as evidence of a lie of something that did not happen. And then Joseph finds himself thrown into a pit. Story number one. Joseph is given this ornate coat by dad as this role of being the Bahor, the firstborn, the second in charge of the entire family. That coat is taken from him by his brothers and is used as evidence of the lie that Joseph has been torn apart by wild animals, and then Joseph is thrown into a pit of an empty cistern. Story number two. Joseph is given a coat by Potiphar in Potiphar's household, where he is put in the position of the second person in charge, the one overseeing all of Potiphar's house. That coat is taken from him by Potiphar's wife and used as an example or as evidence of the lie that he had come in to make sport of her, and Joseph is thrown into a pit in the dungeon. Do you see the deja vu blinkers? And then Joseph, Genesis 39 is going to end with Joseph in this dungeon, in this second pit. How do we expect Joseph is going to respond? How do we expect? Like, is he going to like, why is it all happening again, right? Is Joseph going to curl up in a corner and go, I'm doing everything right, and yet I find myself here? Do we think we're going to find Joseph in this pit, in the dungeon, shaking his fist at the sky? How do we think Joseph's going to respond? Maybe Joseph is going to be faithful again. Right? Maybe Joseph is going to continue to give himself to doing the right things. The story ends this way. It says, but while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Genesis 39 almost starts by starting the cycle all back over again, right? You have the warden who's in charge, and now Joseph, because he continues to do the right things, even when it continues to fall apart on him, he continues to give himself to the right things, and now Joseph finds himself in second in command of a new place, now in this prison. The story is going to continue there next week, but today I want to spend a little bit of time looking at those coats. Because in a lot of ways, the coats that Joseph was given represented something of an identity, right? That first coat, as this favorite son by dad, representing this identity that Joseph has in the family. And what we find is when Joseph's coat was taken from him, when his entire life came crashing down around him, what we found is Joseph was able to remain centered, because it feels like Joseph's identity, to Joseph, his identity wasn't tied to that coat. His identity wasn't tied to that role. It almost feels like Joseph's losing that coat didn't cost him, because it feels like he'd already laid that down years ago. It feels like Joseph has already essentially sacrificed that in recognizing that Joseph's identity was found somewhere else. It was somewhere bigger. That when he was given that role in Potiphar's house, he's given that new cloak, that new role, the new job of being in charge of Potiphar's house. When that gets taken away from him, Joseph's life doesn't come crumbling down. He stays centered. He stays grounded, because it feels like he's already laid that down. Like, Joseph realizes that who he is, that his sense of worth, of purpose, of identity is not tied to the roles that he's played. It's not tied to the job that he has. But it feels like Joseph is showing us what it looks like to have your identity found somewhere else. Jesus is going to tell a story about a dad who gives a son a coat. We call Jesus' stories, often we call them parables. And Jesus tells this really popular story, this really popular parable. We call the parable of the prodigal son. And the way the story goes, Jesus says that there's a dad. And the dad has two sons. And the youngest son one day comes to dad and says, Dad, I want my share of the inheritance. And so dad gives it to him, and this younger son runs off and he squanders it all. He loses all of it. And in this moment, this younger son realizes, I'm living in a way that is even less than what my dad's servants are. I'm going to go back to dad and see if I could even just work for him, because being one of dad's hired men would be better than what I'm living here. And so this younger son makes his way back home, and Jesus tells the story that the moment the dad sees the son, he runs out to greet him, he wraps his arms around him, he puts a ring on his finger, he puts a coat on him, and this coat almost symbolizes this identity of, who are you? You're my son. You are my son, and nothing could ever steal that from you. That almost feels like Joseph. Joseph surrendered all of the other things that he could find worth in, that he could find value, that he could find identity in, because Joseph realized his identity was found squarely in the fact that he was a child of his God. And Jesus tells the story of that dad seeing his son return home, wrapping his arms around him, reminding him again that you are mine. It reminds me again of our show Quarterback. Because there's this beautiful moment. There's this beautiful moment when Kirk Cousins, he had this incredibly promising season. They played really well through the season. They make their way into the playoffs. Kirk, quarterback of the Vikings, they go out and they lose in what Kirk Cousins will say was the biggest game of his career. He loses and he returns home. And when he gets home, his youngest son comes and greets him. And, Daddy, did you win? And Kirk has to tell him, like, no, Daddy didn't win. Daddy lost. And then in the wake of the loss of the biggest game of his career, we see Kirk take his kid and he gives him a bath. And then he puts him in bed and he tucks him in and he reads him a story. And then in bedtime prayers, he sings him a song. And Kirk sings to his kid, on Christ the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand. All other ground is sinking sand. And the moment hits me, because it felt like as I watched it, I'm thinking, that's what Joseph knew. That's what Joseph knew, that in the midst of the highs, in the midst of the lows, in the midst of the peaks, in the midst of the valleys, we can be grounded somewhere else, right? On Christ the solid rock I stand, that we can lay down everything else. We can sacrifice all of it else, because what we know is we can be grounded on the rock, on Christ the solid ground I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. All other ground is sinking sand. Would you pray with me? God, we know that you are the one true rock. That on you we can stand. That on you we can build the foundation of our lives. That then, as the story you Jesus told, that when life threatens to undo us, when life is threatening all around us, God, we know that we are grounded, we are centered on something solid, on something eternal, because we find ourselves in you. And so, God, everything else that we cling to, everything else that we hold to, thinking it gives us value or worth or identity, God, we lay those down, we surrender those to you now. As we find ourselves built on, centered on you, we pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.